from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Capitol Hill, a climactic battle over Medicare reform has been raging all weekend and through this evening. The House passed the bill by 5 votes at 5:53 a.m. Saturday morning after the longest voting session in U.S. history. Today, opponents in the Senate fell narrowly short of the 41 votes needed to filibuster. It looks as if the huge reform will squeak through. Critics of the bill say it is too generous to big business, insurance companies, drug companies, and HMOs. Supporters say this is a now-or-never moment to get seniors relief from the burden of prescription drug costs. But Americans will be paying for this bill for a long time. Republicans have largely supported the overhaul. Democrats have largely opposed. But there have been crossover votes from both sides of the aisle. Montana Democrat Senator Max Baucus spoke out in favor of the bill.
If we don't pass this now, I must say, what are we going to tell our seniors when they say to us, Mr. Senator, Miss Senator, you know, you told us you were going to get prescription drug benefits, but you found some reason to say no, and you voted against it. You didn't give it to us. Why didn't you help us out?
New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg warned his colleagues against passing the bill.
It seems incredibly unfair for one generation to do this to another generation. For us to use our political clout because we are in office to benefit our generation at the expense of our children and our children's children. And yet that's what essentially this bill does.
No matter how you slice it, the bill provides the health care framework that soon, it appears, will await millions of seniors and aging baby boomers. Tonight on Point, inside the Medicaid overhaul, is this package the best the country could do? What's driving this reform? Care for citizens or the sway of big money campaign donors? And will this sweeping bill save Medicare or destroy it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Hawkins, senior editor of Congressional Quarterly. Good evening and welcome, David Hawkins.
Nice to be with you.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
David Hawkins, take us into where things stand in the Senate right now. What has gone on? How near a vote? How near did it come to a filibuster?
Well, it actually came pretty close, not to a filibuster, not to drag your audience down into parliamentary arcana, but they had a vote on the filibuster, and 70 senators voted to do away with the filibuster. And then they had a vote on what they call a budget point of order, which also requires 60 votes. And that only squeaked by with 61 votes. So that was the real close one, was whether this thing violated the Congress's own budget.
So does it now appear that this Medicaid overhaul will pass and win?
Yes, the Medicare overhaul will pass and will clear. This is it. This is the last vote. And it will probably, we think, now happen tonight.
Tonight. And how many Democrats appear to be ready to go over and vote for this? How many Republicans are withholding their votes from it?
We are guessing at this point. This is all a guess. Everybody is confident enough that it has the 50 votes to clear that we haven't probably done the closest possible vote count ourselves this afternoon, because the two votes that I just described earlier in the day were really the key votes. My guess is going to be that there will be 10, 15 Democrats vote yes, and 5, 6, 7 Republicans vote no.
Now, let's look at those two groups for a moment, the 5 to 7 Republicans who oppose the overhaul. Why? Is there a theme to their opposition?
Yes, and I think the soundbite that you used to Senator Gregg was the theme, which is that this is a huge budgetary commitment that the federal budget will rue the day that we committed ourselves to this in Washington, that it will cost far more over time than the official score for this, as they say in Washington, the official bottom line, mm-hmm. is $400 billion over the next 10 years. That is, in most people's view, a conservative estimate, and certainly beyond the 10-year framework for this, the cost will go way up as more baby boomers retire and are kept healthy by prescription
and tumble into the net. And what about the Democrats who have voted for it? Some have been very outspoken against it. Senator Ted Kennedy has talked about this destroying Medicare in the out years, as they say.
Right.
What's the line of the Democrats voting for it?
That's the general line of the Democrats, most of whom are sort of at the liberal end of the spectrum among the Democrats. That it ends Medicare as we know it. It's the first step to dismantling the program altogether.
But a half dozen or more Democrats are voting for it. What's there? Is there a theme to their support?
Best we could do. That's the theme which I think you captured with Senator Baucus, who is the. There were really only two Democrats in the entire Congress who helped negotiate this bill. Senator Baucus, whose soundbite you played a few minutes ago,
yes.
is the top Democrat on the Finance Committee, which writes health care legislation. And a moderate to conservative, very powerful deal-making senator from Louisiana named John Breaux. Those were the two middle-of-the-road moderate Democrats who the Republicans reached out to help them write this bill. Their view is we're this close, and don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And if we don't do this now, the steam for this the long march to get this done will end in nothingness and. We'll be sorry that we didn't take the best we could get.
David Hawkins, we're going to dig into the details tonight, but give us the major elements of this epic legislation, which is now about to be passed.
The basics?
The basics, the major elements.
Well, the basics are that I should probably, you know, I'm going to let my colleague do this. Can I do that?
Well, sure. Who have you got there?
No, I thought your other guest was the expert. I mean,
I see. Well, yes, if you like, I can do that. I'm joined in the studio, in addition to David Hawkins, by Stuart Altman, professor of healthcare policy at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He was appointed by President Clinton to the Bipartisan Commission on the Future of Medicare, 1999-2000. And Stuart Altman, thanks for being here. I guess we should welcome you in.
Thank you.
David Hawkins is passing the baton to you right here, maybe an indication of just how complicated this darn thing is.
It is complicated, and so to say the major elements, I will leave it to the expert as to which one's the major.
All right, we will quickly bring in a professor. Stuart Altman, help us out here. Looking at this, I mean, the one we all know about is a prescription drug benefit for seniors. But when you look at this, what are the major elements that citizens should understand?
Well, there's no question that there's $410 billion of payments for prescription drugs for seniors, which we can get into the complicated aspects of it. It's very
the formula behind all that.
That's
right. We'll put
but,
that aside for a
That's right. But it's a lot more. There is significant extra payments for physicians, mm-hmm. for hospitals, for certain rural hospitals in particular and rural providers.
And why do physicians, hospitals, rural providers need extra payments? For what?
Well, you got to go through it all. Like any other piece of legislation, in this environment, the way we've lived over the last 10 years, this is a grab bag piece of legislation. Physicians were scheduled to get a 4% cut in Medicare. There was significant revolt on the part of many physicians who were refusing to accept Medicare patients.
It just wasn't worth it to them, they were saying.
It wasn't worth it anymore. And many of us, including myself, who had been part of this system for a very long time, felt that this was a bad decision to cut physician payments.
So this may be legitimate to keep doctors actually opening their calendar, their schedules to Medicare patients?
Absolutely. A very positive thing for the Medicare beneficiaries.
Essentially the same for hospitals and
hospitals,
rural clinics?
In particular, rural hospitals have been facing very significant cutbacks in the payments from Medicare. They, too, will get a significant increase.
Now, we're also reading then about what's called subsidies to large American companies or to American employers, $86 billion. What's that for?
Well, you got to understand that right now there is a substantial amount of private companies that provide prescription drug benefits. The fear was that with the passage of this bill, they would all dump their retirees into the Medicare program and it would cost them hundreds of billions of dollars. There was an attempt to subsidize them.
In other words, they'd stop offering the thing because the government began to offer it.
It is a mistake to think that it's a big subsidy to private employers. The alternative would have been worse. That is that they would have dumped all these people into the Medicare program, got a reduced benefit, and it would have cost the program more.
And then on top of all that, we've got privatization. Where does that come in here?
Well, now you're going down the road. I think that the big landmines in this bill are two. One is in 2010, there is going to be an experiment called premium support whereby in six metropolitan areas they're going to attempt to really have serious competition between private insurance and what we call traditional Medicare. And there are substantial subsidies in this bill for private insurance companies that are willing to cover Medicare beneficiaries.
This is what Senator Ted Kennedy is
very
sees
concerned
as the line
about
in the sand.
That.
And why, Stuart Altman?
Well, the fear is that if you do that, you will take the healthy and the better educated and move them out of traditional Medicare. And as a result, the teeter-totter will make traditional Medicare more expensive. And the way the system is set up, the premium that will come from the government would be an average. So people who stayed in traditional Medicare would have to pay an extra payment in order to stay into it.
And the second landmine you referred to?
The second landmine is actually bigger than the first. And that is, there is a provision in this law, if it's become law, that says once Medicare spending for reaches 45% of its total coming from general revenues, 7 years before that, the government is going to have to make a call whether they want to continue to spend at that rate. And if they don't, they have to figure out a way to cut Medicare,
right,
which is probably going to happen sometime between 2008 and 2010, which is only 6 years from now.
And just as the baby boomers start to
even
really
tumble.
Even before
the baby boomers come into the program. And now, the good of it is that we as a country are going to have to decide whether we want to continue Medicare. And I sure hope we do. But the fear is that people will look at that and say no, and then it will cause significant cuts in payments to providers and in the services that are provided.
Jack Beatty, that's a heck of a tripwire sitting out there now, not so very far away.
It is, and there's an even more pernicious element of it. The funding would be done, if any funding had to be done to make up the difference, it could not be done from income taxes. It would have to be done by either an increase in the payroll tax, which is regressive, or a cut in benefit. But, you know, one way to look at this bill is to ask yourself who did and who did not make campaign contributions. Well, the drug industry spent $22 million last year, 80% of it for the GOP. What did they get? Well, they got the federal government. Basically, they got the federal government out of the business of bargaining down the cost of drugs.
We didn't even refer to that, but that would have been an option here to allow for a kind of big market leverage being swung by the federal government. They've declined.
Right, there's
forbidden.
It's prevented
in the bill. The VA does it. That's how it gets lower prices on its drugs. They don't get Canada. Canada, the possibility of getting free drugs, you know, lower cost drugs from Canada for consumers, gone.
You mean that's going to be cut off or more fiercely defended?
It is that, in the final.
But subject to the what the HHS says, which
that's
means
right.
It's not going to happen.
So Canada access in question, right?
And they have less pressure to do business with the generic drug manufacturers. There's a proposal in there that would have eliminated some of the tricks the big drug companies use to keep down the generics. On the other side, who didn't make campaign contributions? Well, the taxpayer. All these subsidies to private industry. Our children, this is all done on the credit card. We're leaving it to the next generation. The poor, according to one estimate I've seen, 6 million people, some in nursing homes, others at home, are going to actually spend more for their prescription drugs than they would under current law with this thing. And finally, and most insidiously, those of us with employer-based health insurance didn't lobby, and we're going to pay for it because there's something in this called health savings accounts that basically means that at any of our employers, the healthier employee can say, I don't want the regular plan. Give me a very high deductible, and I'm going to put the money you give me, employer, into a tax-free savings account, tax-free going in and tax-free coming out.
So the pool shrinks.
And that is going to shrink the pool, and according to one estimate by the RAND Corporation, that could double what you and me and everybody else pays for our insurance from our employers.
Well, that would not feel good. David Hawkins, how do you read the politics on this? How overt what were the campaign contribution lobbying levers in here?
Oh, it was pretty overt, but I think I think your other guests have illustrated all the incredible forces that were at work and the ones that weren't at work, which are really the ones for our children and who will get the bill, and for me, I guess I'll get the bill. I'm only 40, so by the time I'm old enough to benefit from this, it'll probably be time to pay for it. The politics of this are quite I think quite unsettled. I think there are many out there who are worried or who are glad
David Hawking, hold the thought. We'll come right back to you after a short break. Sorry, okay. We're talking tonight about the sweeping and hotly debated Medicare reform making its way through the Senate right now. You can join us 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the sweeping and hotly debated Medicare reform making its way right now through the final stages of congressional approval. It could come tonight in the U.S. Senate. The U.S. House passed it early Saturday morning, 5:53 a.m. Saturday morning after an all-nighter. It's delivering on a huge Bush campaign promise. The health care framework that now awaits millions and millions of baby boomers and seniors right now is being decided. Is this package the best the country could do? What's driven this reform? Care for citizens or care for big money campaign donors? What do you think? Will this save Medicare or destroy it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined in the studio by Stuart Altman, professor of healthcare policy at Brandeis University, by our own Jack Beattie, and from Washington by David Hawking, senior editor for Congressional Quarterly. And David, you were just summarizing the politics at work here.
I was going to try, which is very briefly that while this has been claimed now as a high priority of President Bush, and he's eager to sign it, this was something that the Democrats wanted to do too back before this became a Republican Congress. And both parties said that this was something that ought to be done. It's just a two.
They sure did very loudly in the last presidential campaign.
And what I was going to say right before the break was that I think that there is some gladness on both sides, or at least on the Republican side, on the proponent side, that the full effect of this really will not be understood by the public until after the 2004 election. That there is some quiet worry that this thing might not work the way it's intended, and they're just glad that it'll be after the next election that if there is sort of generic general public disdain for it, that will bubble up after the next election.
David, forgive me, but it seems to be a mounting list of things that don't clearly fully come home until after the 2004 election at this point. I mean, no small portion of war costs, further tax cuts and deficits, and now this. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. Surely even the tax cuts that have gone through since President Bush has been the president, the big cuts actually come in the later years, and then the whole thing is supposed to expire altogether in about 2011. Nobody thinks that'll happen, that Congress will extend it, and then it'll cost even more money in the
future. So off we go. A funny way to do business, in a way. It doesn't seem entirely forthright. David Hawking, I know we have to...
It's the Washington way.
Well, I guess so. I know we have to let you go, but thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I enjoyed being here.
David Hawking is senior editor for the Congressional Quarterly. Stuart Altman, you're furrowing your brow furiously there.
Well, I just want to take... Jack, you clearly have read this bill well and you understand it, but let me take a different tack. I was on the Bipartisan Commission on the Future of Medicare, and we had a piece of legislation that had all the negatives but didn't have any drug benefits. The other way of looking at this, if the conservative Republicans were left alone, all they would have done are the cuts. They would have put in the premium support. They would have put in the restrictions on the size of Medicare. They would have put in those extra little lobby dollars. But they couldn't get their bill through either. Mm-hmm. What we have is this trade-off, and it's a very tough trade-off, 51-49, 49-51. There's $410 billion for drug benefits for lower-income, middle-income, and people that have high medical risk. It is a tough call, and that's why you got 15 Democrats supporting this bill. You can be as cynical as you want, and I can be as cynical as you want, but you know what? We will not see a bill like this for a decade or two.
Why
do
people say that, Stuart Altman? Why this now or never idea around this
legislation? The now or never is that this country is so evenly split. There is this group, the Judge Gregs of the world, do not want to see the federal government in this program. They want to see the end of Medicare. They do not want to support it. And, they can talk about our children. Well, I think our children actually would support the Medicare program. So the politics of it is that both the Republicans and the Democrats are afraid of the lobby group. And you have a conservative Republican president who under no set of circumstances would have supported this bill had he not feared that had he not done it, he could lose the election in the next.
And the lobby group that they're afraid of is the senior set, the AARP, the drug industry, who?
Well, it wasn't the drug industry. It was the senior citizens who said, this is our top priority item. We don't want to hear anything else. We need drugs. And they've been saying this for 20 years. and it's gotten worse and worse and worse. So they, if they didn't do something, he did stand to potentially lose on this issue.
So what a melange of things here. On the one hand, the drug benefit comes in. On the other hand, elements in here which were put forward by people who would like to see Medicare go away.
Absolutely. And that's what the trade-off was. And the most conservatives in our – look what you had. You have the most conservatives and the most liberal elements are against this bill. This is a moderates bill.
Mm-hmm.
And on both sides. And you heard the speeches. And I can understand there are landmines in there. But those landmines could also blow up all by themselves and have no impact on the program.
Let's hear from the conservative side of that equation. We're joined from Washington right now by Ed Haselmeyer. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's read the Medicare proposal front to back. He joins us now from Washington. Good evening and welcome, Ed Haselmeyer.
Thank you.
You've heard our conversation around the voting and seen how the vote's lining up. Ed, what's your view of this bill?
Well, the whole thing from start to finish was a political exercise. I think that was the point that Stuart was making. I mean, basically, the idea is that if you pass what is essentially the, you know, other side's priorities, then the other side won't have those to campaign on in the next election, and you can win the election.
I.e., the compassionate conservative George Bush passes the prescription drug benefit.
Yeah, so you know, a lot of conservatives were, from the very beginning when he first campaigned, wondering about this guy on the compassionate conservative, was he really compassionate conservative in the way that we understand it, which is a reformist activist agenda to solve problems but in a different way than they traditionally are.
A market-oriented way.
Yeah, you know, and this is, things like, you know, school choice and stuff like that.
So this looks to you like old-fashioned government?
Old-fashioned, just I'm gonna adopt the other guy's agenda and say me too.
So is your critique, what, that it's too costly, that the government shouldn't be medical business?
Here's the main thing. I mean, the biggest issue here is the one that is least talked about, and that happens. And that question is, what happens when you and I and probably most of your other guests retire in, you know, 10, 20 years? What happens to us? Okay,
I'll still be working, Stu, but that's, Ed, but that's okay.
Yeah, but in some ways, you know, I mean, because the Medicare program as it currently exists is not sustainable. You cannot deliver everything to everybody, and certainly you can't do that if you're going to go from, you know, 40 million Medicare beneficiaries to 70 million.
So you're saying the country can no longer afford the commitment it made in the 1960s?
Yeah, and just like any other country that has a national health system can't afford their commitments either. So the question is, what do you do about it? Now, the classic national health insurance route is you hollow out the benefit. In other words, in theory, you can get all this, but if you, as an individual, actually want a procedure or a visit to the doctor, well, that's a different story. And, of course, you get, you know, rationing, whatever you want to call it.
Okay, just make it more difficult, yeah?
Right. So it's theoretically there, but in reality, you don't necessarily get it. That's one way to do it.
That's not what this bill
is to say, look, let's stop promising you the moon and say, this is what we've got. You take it and do the best with it. So I want to know where, when I retire in 20 years, I can just say, give me the value of my Medicare benefits, adjust it however you want for age and wealth and all the rest. Just give me the value and I'll go elsewhere.
Ed, let me just move aside. This idea that we can't afford this when you retire is a lot of nonsense. This is a very rich country. We could afford just about anything we want. The truth is we may not want to support it, but I actually believe we will. It's like saying to the workers, from now on, your health insurance that you get can't go up by more than your wages. How many of us would accept that? During the 90s, when we tried to keep health care costs at the rate of growth of general, we rebelled. We want more health care. And you know what? This country can't afford it, and I think we will pay it. It will require a greater percentage of our wealth going into this program. But it's a lot of nonsense to say that we can't afford it.
Ed Haselmeyer, can the country not afford it, I guess?
It can't afford it this way. The unfunded liability of Medicare as it is currently, without the addition of this, is $5 trillion. Okay, so you're now going to add another $2 trillion to it.
And the prescription drug benefit and so on.
Right. You know, this prescription drug benefit is $400 billion in the first, you know, years. It's going to be $700 billion in the next 10 years. And that's assuming that they don't make it more generous, because this is, frankly, a fairly pared-down benefit.
So, can we cut to the bottom line then of what you would propose as an alternative? Would you take away Medicare? And then what would happen to seniors who didn't have resources to pay for health care?
No, wait a second. I say. What I would propose as an alternative, and this was what the Broad-Thomas Commission proposed as an alternative, is to say, look, in effect, the government will approve plans that have broad benefit categories and then give the plans the flexibility to decide what kind of benefits and they're going to offer. Okay. And they will provide a contribution per enrollee. Now, you can adjust that seven different ways from Sunday. You can adjust it by age. You can adjust it by geography.
Is that the hollowing out scenario?
You can adjust it by income, et cetera. No, what it is it's in effect a defined contribution scenario. And this is how employers are moving, and this is what the federal government does with its own employees.
But it sounds like a hollowing out. You're saying there's not the money there, so let's put it
no,
in a...
What it's saying is, see... Here's the difference. What it's saying is this is what we have that we can contribute.
Yeah. Okay. That is the employer.
Sorry?
The employer or the individual.
Or the government in this case.
Okay.
Would say this is what I've got that I can contribute. And here is a whole bunch of options. And you pick what you find is most suitable. And your choices drive them to provide you with best value for money, i.e. give you the most for your dollars. That's the whole point of competition in this. And this is a very important point, because when we talk about competition here, we're not talking about a lot of what has been tried. In other words, the Medicare Plus Choice program. There are two models. One is a kind of procurement model where the government says, well, here's what I want in great detail, pages and pages of detail, and you have to give it to me, and who gives it to me as the lowest bidder.
Yeah,
that was
yeah,
the
yeah.
Medicare Plus Choice.
Yeah.
That's the route they continue with in this bill. The competition model is what they do in the federal employee health benefits program, which is to say to the consumer, here's the money, you shop, and you decide, and each year these vendors come back with their best offer to attract your business. Now, that system has worked longer than Medicare. It's been in existence since 1960, 40 years. Okay, and it not only works for the workers, but it works for retirees.
But that's not the path we're on with this bill, Stuart Altman.
Ed, first of all, that was not the Broad-Thomas bill. The Broad-Thomas bill allowed the premiums to go up along with the cost of care. It was not a fixed amount of money. You've miscast what the federal employee benefit. I happen to support the federal employee benefit. It grows by the cost of health care, and which is what I think
no,
this
– We're not saying that the money's fixed forever and
all
ever.
Right. No, so as long as we're clear on that, the program will grow. Actually, the experiment will do that. The big difference between the Broad-Thomas, it did not include drugs. And in 2003, not to have decent drug coverage in Medicare was a travesty.
Right. It should include drugs, absolutely, just like FEHBP includes drugs.
Exactly. And now we've got a lot more besides. Ed Haselmeyer, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Ed Haselmeyer is a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Lynn's calling from Frankfort, Kentucky. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I was just calling to say, I was going to call to say something else, but I wanted to address something that came up after I called. Someone said this is a rich company, rich country, and we can afford what we want. That's probably true, but saying it's a rich country doesn't mean that all the people in it are rich. I can afford less and less health care every year, and I'm a very well-educated American, middle class. And I am getting less and less health care for my money every year because the costs keep going up. The employers are perhaps offering more. I don't know if they are or not, but I can't afford it.
So can you tell whether – do you welcome this new bill, Lynn, or do you,
no,
can you tell
yet? No, I do not. I do not. Specifically, let me address the prescription benefit.
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned, this is not a prescription drug benefit. This is a pharmacy company benefit.
Now, why do you say that?
Because it's not – addressing the issue of the cost of medication. It's not addressing why American medical care is so much more expensive than it is in every other industrialized country. What it is it's taking the taxpayers' money and putting it into the drug company's pocket, which is typical of what this administration and this Congress have done. They will not take on the corporations.
Lynn, let us pick up that point right there, and thank you very much for your call. Stuart Altman, what about this issue that the government is specifically forbidden, I guess, in this bill from using its buying power to drive down the cost of prescription drugs as a Sam's or a BJ's might? Why have they walked away from that option?
I think that's a legitimate concern, but I will tell you the reason why they're not walking away. I think we are making a bet, and it's a bet that not everyone wants to make. And that is, if you look into the future on the ability of this country to change its delivery system, prescription drugs actually can be one of the benefits. And the question becomes, and it's a debatable one, and I can argue on both sides of this issue, that if you significantly cut on the payments of drugs to the drug companies, you can significantly cut the amount of research that goes on, and the future generation of drugs just won't be there.
So Americans are going to continue to pay the highest drug prices in the world.
And we have become the supporters of that for the rest of the world. Now, there is a legitimate case to be made that the rest of the world needs to share in those costs, and our drug prices should come down. Now, if the government were to go and do what she wanted, this bill would have been dead before it began. Although there's a case to be made that we are subsidizing the future generation of drugs availability.
A lot of realities intersecting here. Ellen's calling from Lac des Flambeaux, Wisconsin. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm a senior citizen who buys my drugs through AARP, and I wondered whether the reason they're so enthusiastic about this bill, which I am not, is that they're basically a drug company.
The AARP, you're saying?
Yes. All my drugs come through AARP so that I can get them a little less expensively than from the local drugstore.
Now that's interesting. So you're saying that
a great number of people besides me.
They're more an insurance company. I think there's a lot of arguments being made that they are a big insurance company. They're not a drug company, but they're an insurance company.
But Ellen has some AARP role in the drugs that she gets. She's afraid that they just don't want competition from Canada.
No, they're an insurance company, and I think she has a legitimate case to be made. The drug companies, the Mercks and the Pfizers, are in a different category. And I think this whole business with Canada is just going to go away.
Ellen, do you feel betrayed by the AARP in this legislation?
They certainly don't represent me. In fact, I'm trying to decide where I'm going to get my drugs because I'm tired of them representing every single senior citizen as thinking what they do, especially on an issue like this.
And you're not buying it after this one. Jack Beatty, what do you hear in all this? What a world.
Well, I'm wondering, and I think others are. The Democrats were saying this could happen. Charlie Cook, who's perhaps the best election analyst in the country, flat out says that this bill will be an albatross around the necks of Republicans and the president in the election campaign. That when seniors find out what's in here and what's not, how much they're going to have to pay in out-of-pocket expenses, when they find out about this business of the formulary, that basically, I won't even get into it, when they start to look into the penetralia of this thing, some people think there's going to be a reaction quite like the one we had in the late 80s with catastrophic care under Medicare. When that was passed, again, bipartisan, the Congress had to come back a year later and repeal it because the seniors were so furious.
But, you know, Jack, we heard earlier from David Hawking saying that the bet is that these details won't really become clear before November a year from now.
Well, I don't doubt it, and that's why the bill is not going to take effect until the year 2006.
I think the Democrats are going to really push hard to make those details available. I think Jack has a lot of truth in what he's saying.
We're going to have to come back and look at just what those shockers may be in here. President Bush is obviously banking on this as a real asset for him in the election. It looks like it could be. What do you think? Has President Bush now delivered on his campaign promise to provide prescription drug coverage and do the politics and fine print and contributions matter to you if the pills are cheaper in your pocket? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the sweeping and hotly debated Medicare reform making its way through the final stages of congressional approval tonight. Could be passed in the U.S. Senate tonight. The House passed it very early Saturday morning. My guest tonight in the studio, Stuart Altman, professor of healthcare policy at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He was on the Bipartisan Commission for the Future of Medicare that met in 1999 and 2000. Jack Beatty is with us as well. You can join us. What do you think? Are you with the naysayers who say it's a looming disaster or with the AARP who says bring it on? Is the health care of America's seniors more secure tonight? And can the country afford the health care it wants? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Scott's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a 32-year-old male. I have multiple sclerosis. I've lived with it for 6 years. And it's not enough that the Bush administration had to interfere with the development of new therapies for those of us with MS. But to now give us this bill, my prescription drugs cost They started at, when I started 2 years ago, there were $950 a month.
And did you have Medicare support with that, Scott?
No, but I most people with MS can't work after 90% can't work after 10 years following diagnosis.
So do you have Medicare support now, or you're looking forward to the time when you will?
But I will long before I'm retired.
Right.
And more than likely, I hope not. Anyway, my drugs were $950 a month thereabouts when I 2 years ago started them. Today they're over $1,200 a month, and I can't believe our government would give up the ability to control some of the drug prices. We need that.
Scott, your line's getting rough on us, so we're going to have to take it there. But Stuart Altman, that's a good prompt for us to step in here and look at exactly what the drug benefit is for people who are now on Medicare or who will be in years to come. What's the difference they're going to see?
Well, it is complicated, but let me try to do it as simply as I can. Basically, an individual will have to pay a premium, about $35 a month. And then there will be a $250 deductible. So for the first $250, you get nothing. From $250 to about $2,250, the government pays 75% and you pay 25%. And then you have a hole from $2,250 to $3,600.
And the point of that hole is that gap?
We got to go back. As my friend Stan Wallach has said many times, in order to have a really decent drug benefit, you needed about $1.5 trillion over 10 years. And the president and the budget people decided on an arbitrary $400 billion. Once they did that, they had to figure out a way to save a lot of money. And the way they saved it is to create a hole in the middle where there's no coverage.
So a lot of people will never hit that 2,000.
Well, they'll go from 2,250 to 3,600.
But I mean, it's politically palatable because anyone who doesn't hit 2,200 a year in expenses won't hit the hole.
No, that's right. So they will get benefits. They will get 75% of their expenses. Then they get the hole, and then they have to pay it all, which is like 100% coinsurance.
So another $1,400.
Exactly. And then above $3,600, the government pays 95%.
So if it's really catastrophic, really high, they come back
in.
So
it covers the really very high drug bills where there's a small number of people.
Right.
Probably, people that really have cancer and others.
Mm-hmm.
And it covers people that have moderate drug bit of.
But in the middle, there's a bit of a hole. Now, Jack was talking about the shockers in here that he thinks are going to bring the mob to the gate next year.
Well, the mob to the gate is if you have about $800-$900 worth of drug, it's going to cost you more than you get. If you have about $1,000-$1,200, you sort of break even. And even if you have about $2,000, you're going to get just a little benefits. And these people are going to think, my God, I have a drug benefit, and I'm paying almost as much as the benefit is worth. And so there's going to be a lot of people who are going to have to pay more than they get.
And they're going to feel ripped off. But that won't really kick in until the year 2006, is that right?
It doesn't begin until then. But as I said, I think the politicians are going on the other side are going to be hammering at what you're not going to get.
They're going to say this is a sham.
That's right. The difference between this and catastrophic, you had to start paying right away and you got no benefits. This one, at least you don't have to pay right away either.
No easy choices here. Kevin's calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes, 2 points, both of which have some kind of graphic image. The first is sick people, to the degree that they're ill, being seen as rotten cherries by the insurance companies competing with Medicare in the future. And the other image is of Ted Kennedy as the Dutch boy with his finger in the dike and trying to hold back something that if he takes his finger out or he's not successful in holding off that hole, the water's going to come in and continually do so and open that hole until it eventually breaks down the wall.
So you're no fan of this reform, Kevin?
No, structurally, the prescription drug benefit is a worm on the hook. It's not the key to this. The more important thing is the structural change. It'll have consequences in the future. Private companies are legally bound to try to maximize their profit, and I've got some training as an economist. I would try to cherry pick. The HMOs a while back in my area, they would even sponsor these dances for the elderly with food and dance music and everything. But, of course, no one in the nursing home who was homebound or severely ill, the minority that
If you can come out dancing, they want you in their program. We've got it, Kevin. Thanks for your call. Stwaltman, you supported this despite your reservations. Kevin says the drug coverage is the worm on the hook.
Well, I mean, he has a point. I mean, there's no question that there's reform sitting out there that some people think is reform. Some people think it's the end of the program. The positive of it is that it'll offer more choices, and a lot of Americans like choices. The negative of it is that the potential for cherry picking. Now, there are attempts.
And that means that down the road, the health company, where's the cherry picking come in and how? Explain that.
In 2010, there is an experiment. It's not a full-blown program, where the government would create an average premium, similar to what Ed wanted from the Heritage Foundation, mm-hmm. and say to you, okay, here's the average payment premium, and I'm going to give that to you as a voucher. You can either buy private insurance or you can buy traditional Medicare. If the private insurance is cheaper, because then you can don't have to pay in addition. If the traditional Medicare is more expensive, you're going to have to pay a premium.
Right.
Now, to the extent that the cheapness or non-cheapness is the result of efficiencies, you like it. But to the extent that the traditional Medicare has the sicker people in it, it's not fair. Now, to be fair with the program, there is what's called a risk-adjusted premium in there. So sicker people will get more money than the non-sick. The problem is our ability to really do a good job of doing that. So some people fear that it will destroy the Medicare program.
People won't all be in this together. Some will be siphoned off to private coverage, as Kevin says.
On the other hand, you know, we've done this before, and ultimately the traditional Medicare has won out, just like the health medical savings account. When all gets said and done, Americans are very risk-averse when it comes to their health care, and they're not going to want to gamble so easily. So if these cherry pickers really do a lousy job, they're going to be out of business. I'm less fearful of that destroying the Medicare program. I'm more fearful of that 45%. If Americans turn away from Medicare and saying, I'm not willing to support any more money going into this program will go under.
And the 45% being?
As I said before, there is a provision in this that says once the part of Medicare, which is paid for by general revenue, reaches 45%, mm-hmm. 7 years before that.
Yeah. That projection.
The 7 years before that projection, the president is obligated to send up a bill either asking for more money, and as Jack pointed out, that money has to come from general revenues.
Not from income tax.
From a premium tax, mm-hmm. or he has to cut the program.
Jack, the future is being rearrayed before us here.
It is, and, you know, I mean, it's easy to see camel's noses under the tent, but the fact is that one of the key players in this is Bill Thomas
yes.
of California. That man is on record as opposed to employer-based health insurance. Now, think about that. And there's a mechanism in here, this medical savings account, that is the camel's nose under that tent. Thomas does not want your employer insuring you. He wants you to get some kind of voucher and insure yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think you can do that at a lower cost than your employer, you've got something else coming. So that is a huge thing under the door here, put in by an opponent of the basic structure of what we take as a medical, you know, as the rest of us not in Medicare, take as our granted.
What a funny time we live in where that nose under the tent, as you say, comes wrapped in the image of greater benefits. It's a lot to keep our eyes on. We're going cross-eyed trying here. Morgan's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Morgan. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
I had a brief editorial and then a question about Canadian versus American prescription. I want to preface this by saying that I, too, like your other caller from Madison, have about $1,200 worth of prescriptions a month because I had an organ transplant.
Okay.
My friend works for one of the major drug companies, and when they're really focused in on recently on all these seniors going to Canada for their drugs, I emailed her and I said, why do you think American drugs are so much more expensive? And she kind of gave me the same stuff that you see in the media about, well, we're the ones who do the research, blah, blah, blah. And then she went on in the very next paragraph to say that she was going on for her MBA that the company is going to be paying for. Well, I owe tens of thousands of dollars for my master's degree. It's not me directly yet, but I don't feel like paying for her master's degree on top of that.
Morgan, take us right to your question here.
My question is, if once these senior citizens or people with chronic expensive drug prices reach their caps, are they going to have any punishment for then turning to Canada for their drugs? And that's my question.
Got it. Thanks, Morgan.
Well, first, there are a couple of things in here. From now on, seniors will be getting their insurance through these prescription drug benefit managers, which have about a 20% discount, 15 to 20%. Even when they're in that cap, in that middle ground, they still will be able to get that 15 to 20% discount.
Okay.
So the gap between the Canadian prices and the American prices really narrows. The worst position now is, unfortunately, the people that aren't insured that have to pay the full retail price, and the gap
is... So the poorest, the unemployed.
That's right. So that will change. So seniors will get a shot that are significantly a significant savings, not as much as in Canada. I think the Canadian system is a more complicated, and I don't have time in the show why, the good and the bad of that. But the reality of it is that that won't last. The drug companies will not continue to sell drugs to Canada at deep discounts and then turn around and see those drugs come to the United States. They're either going to raise the price to the Canadians or they're going to cut off their supply.
Bob's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Very quickly, I want to pick up on your point. Mentioned earlier about the tax cuts kicking in after the election and this program kicking in after the election. Well, the tax cuts are in the trillions of dollars. This health program is in the billions of dollars. And I really think that I see a time after the election when this administration, assuming they get reelected, will turn around and say, oh, my God, you know, look at this. We just don't have enough tax money to pay for this health program for you, the seniors.
It's easy to imagine that, isn't it, Bob? Let us pick it up, and thanks for your call, Stuart Altman. How about it?
I think he's absolutely correct, and that's what I was saying before. The tax cuts are in the trillions of dollars. This program's in the billions. If we hadn't, that's why they have created a crisis. They have pushed down the revenue and pushed up the expenses, so we've created a crisis. And I'm hoping that at some point the American people are going to turn around and do exactly the opposite. They're going to say, we want Medicare. We not only want it for our mothers and our grandparents, but we want it for ourselves. And so the 40-year-olds out in the audience, you got to make a decision. If you turn against the seniors of today, you're going to turn against your own generation when they come up. And I'm hoping that at some point we're going to say, we are rich enough, but we do need to tax ourselves for this benefit.
But that tax, under this legislation, won't be an income tax. It'll be something special.
You know what? You can change legislation. I think ultimately we will probably do a combination of a premium tax and a general. There's nothing that says you can't modify this legislation tomorrow.
Jack Beatty, big numbers, big consequences, a lot converging on points just a little bit more distant than the election.
Yes, let's get to the good of it. I mean, people are going to be spending less. Many people will be spending less for their drugs. But on the other hand, many poorer people, I come back to that again, are going to actually, because of the perversity of this, be spending more. Now, that's almost like social Darwinism. You know, you actually hurt the poorest. And
Jack,
that I can't understand. I don't understand how a Democratic Party, I don't understand how those 15 or whatever it was Democratic senators could ever stand for something like that. My mother has been in a nursing home. I know what that's like.
Hang on, Jack. Stuart's shaking his head.
We
just got a few seconds here. Stuart Altman.
Jack, I totally agree if that was the reality. I think the reason why the poor potentially could lose is that they are being subsidized not by the federal government, by the states. The states stand to get billions of dollars of help here. I hope they will turn that and help those poor people you're talking about. The states are big winners in this program.
There's hope to go on, more to come. Stuart Altman, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Stuart Altman, professor of healthcare policy at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.